You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 8th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA.
You've only done that 3,000 times.
Last night was late. It was a late night last night. On the program today, Don Deft, Ann Newman, journalist and Pulitzer Center grantee, writing on the Ethiopian-Tigrayan conflict. Then on the program, Don Deft, lead organizer with the Emergency Workplace Organizer Committee, and Sam Harshner, organizer and adjunct instructor, political science of history at Marquette University. Also on the program today, Biden State of the Union draws Republicans into a pact to protect Social Security. Earthquake in Turkey and Syria. Death toll now surpasses 11,000, 15,000 injured. Democrats sweep Pennsylvania special elections. They take the Pennsylvania House for the first time in 12 years. Despite slowing inflation, the Fed chair gives away the game. He's determined to fight employment gains. House Republicans will question Twitter executives via Committee on Government Oversight on Hunter Biden's dick pics. Why not? Matt Gaetz now on the Weaponization of Government Against Conservatives Committee. DOJ says may end to the COVID emergency, that being May the month, will automatically terminate Title 42. Florida doctors sound alarm over high school sports requirement in Florida of menstrual information from supposed girls who are playing in sports there. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma is out today. I am a little bit, it was a late night. Bradley's here, of course. But Matt has triumphantly returned from his, what would you call that? Was it sort of a vacation?
No, it was like a wedding-based vacation.
A
I think I'd call it, technically.
A wedding-based vacation.
Yep.
Sun and fun, right?
A lot of fun. I enjoyed myself immensely. There was a basketball court there. I practiced step-back threes, which weren't a thing the last time I was playing basketball. So got to feel like a stork bouncing around. It was very fun. So I enjoyed myself. Got a little bit of sun, too.
There you go, folks. All right, let's get right into this. We're going to do a couple of stuff from the State of the Union. Most of it is going to come in the fun half. We also did some immediate analysis last night after the State of the Union, Emma and I did, which was slightly tainted by both, I think, wine here and some whiskey at home. But nevertheless, pretty spot on, I have to say. You may want to check that out. But let's just start with this. And this is, regular listeners will know that I tend to listen to the AP News in the morning, the top and the bottom of the hours, just to get a sense of what normies are hearing about political events, because largely that's where people are going to hear about the State of the Union address, that type of presentation. Those are the broad stroke narratives. And it was pretty striking because the AP was sort of playing it very subtly. but they played two clips. They basically said Joe Biden called for America to unite and for the parties to work together. And that was they played something like this clip.
In fact, I signed over 300 bipartisan pieces of legislation since becoming president, from reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, the Electoral Count Reform Act, the Respect for Marriage Act that protects the right to marry the person you love. And to my Republican friends, if we could work together the last Congress, there's no reason we can't work together and find consensus on important things in this Congress as well. Folks, you all are as formed as I am, but I think the people sent us a clear message. Fighting for the sake of fighting, power for the sake of power, conflict for the sake of conflict gets us nowhere. That's always been my vision of our country, and I know it's many of yours. To restore the soul of this nation, to rebuild the backbone of America, America's middle class, and to unite the country.
And then the AP said, but the Republican response was given by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and this is what she had to say.
And I don't have a lot in common. I'm for freedom. He's for government control. At 40, I'm the youngest governor in the country. And at 80, he's the oldest president in American history. Ugh. I'm the first woman to lead my state. And he's the first man to surrender his presidency to a woke mob that can't even tell you what a woman is. And the radical left's America, Washington taxes you and lights your hard-earned money on fire. But you get crushed with high gas prices.
Okay, that's I mean, they didn't even play that the Washington lights your money on fire. They just played that part there. And there was really no comment, but pretty hard to come away with that thinking that they aren't sort of like there's not a subtle critique there. And here's the thing. If there are any other people, I mean, like, I sort of feel like the 2020 midterms, I should say the 2022 midterms resolved the how worried are we about the woke mob taking over everything in terms of like a country. I understand that in the conservative mindset, in the reactionary mind, this is going to play over and over and over and over again. And every time it circles back around, it's going to be just as intense and terrifying until they move on to the next thing, right? Sharia law,
Jade Helm.
Jade Helm. I mean, like it just there the caravan, and they just keep cycling through these things, and it's going to keep going. But in terms of like what the State of the Union address is, it's really just two competing. Essentially, one person plays, and in the broad strokes, it was pretty devastating. Not just because the odd thing is that I think Sarah Huckabee Sanders is the least damaged Republican in all of the responses to the State of the Union. Like, it destroyed the careers of most of the Republicans who did it.
Jindal,
I think Scott Brown. I mean, like, it goes on and on. But I actually think that she, you know, handled herself well. She wasn't, you know, Marco Rubio-ing it with the water. That, you know, that's where the whole water bottle thing came from, with Marco Rubio was so thirsty. But in terms of like hurting the relative or helping the relative parties, there's just no fish in that pond when you're going out talking about the woke mob. And then the other problem is that you could hear it right there in those two sentences. He's the oldest president that we've ever had, right? Which is true. And that's a narrative. He's so old that he's ineffectual. He can't get anything done. But then in the next breath, she's talking about how the woke mob has taken over and is doing all this stuff. with him as, I guess, presumably as some type of puppet, you know, the, and it really is just too complicated of a narrative. Like, who am I supposed to vote against now? Do I vote against the woke mob and keep in the nice old grandpa? Or do I vote out the grandpa because he's not doing anything? But won't that just leave the woke mob? What are we supposed to do if I'm someone who even remotely is sympathetic to her message?
Yeah, like is he dangerous or not? I think is the hard question to reconcile. Like, is he the dangerous one, or are the deep state bureaucrats who are unelected the dangerous ones?
Well, and the point is like, you know, on one hand, they're trying to say he's ineffectual. So he's dangerous if you let him drive the car down the road because he's too old to drive and he's going to hit somebody. But they're also saying nobody's letting him drive. Somebody else is driving him. And we just don't like where the car is going. But that doesn't implicate the driver so much. He's more of a victim in the second half of the narrative. And so they have a real problem. They haven't quite figured this out. When we go into the second half, we will play more clips. The Social Security stuff is, I think, amazing. And it really ends up being, not even necessarily to Biden's credit as much as it is, it's a great thing to have happened for those of us who care about Social Security and Medicare. And there's a real opportunity for Democrats going forward there. We'll see if they take it. But we've got a couple of words from our sponsors before we get to Ann Newman, who did some reporting on the ground in Ethiopia. First sponsor of the day is Henson Shaving. You know, for a long time, we were sponsored by another razor company. And when I basically grew a beard and stopped shaving on a regular basis, I stopped shaving and decided like I didn't want to have a subscription. I didn't want to deal with a lot of like plastic waste. And then these guys showed up. Henson Shaving is a family-owned aerospace parts manufacturer. They have made parts for the International Space Station. They've made it for the Mars rover. And now they are bringing precision shaving, or engineering, I should say, to your shaving experience. You know, disposable razors, among the other problems, tend not to give necessarily the best of shaves. And apparently the discomfort that people are they face is not a function of how sharp the blade is, but it has to do with how far from the razor it extends. So you get these sort of like micro wobbles. By using their aerospace equipment, Henson makes metal razors that extend just 0.0013 inches, which is apparently like less than the thickness of a human hair, from the razor. And that means a secure and stable blade with a vibration-free shave. The razor has built-in channels, which I think you can see there, that evacuate the hair, and the shaving cream makes clogging virtually impossible. So no more, I guess, some people I know use their thumbs. I just bang it on the sink 100 times and run water until it comes out. But the other thing that's great about this is that these guys set out to make the best razor, not necessarily the best razor company business plan, as it were. Once you buy this razor, it costs you somewhere between $3 and $7 a year to shave. There are no plastic. There is no subscriptions. There's no proprietary blades that you need to, you know, pump in or whatever. There's no planned obsolescence. They use standard dual edge blades, gives you that old school straight razor shave with the benefits of a new school technology, i.e. Mars rover technology. So once you own a Henson razor, It's, you know, maybe $3 to $5 to $7 a year to maintain the blades, but they're giving our audience a 2-year supply of blades for free. You just go to hensonshaving.com/majority. That's H-E-N-S-O-N shaving.com/majority. Add a razor and 100-pack of blades to your cart, then enter the code majority to get your blades for free. The link will be in the description. I got a black one of these, incidentally. They got a couple of different models, but they're great razors. And the link will be in the description, podcast, YouTube, all of that. And also, today's program and my presence here, not feeling like a disaster, is sponsored by ZBiotics. ZBiotics is a pre-alcohol, I guess what they call it that? I don't know. That's what I call it. It is a pre-alcohol probiotic. And it is genetically engineered. You drink a little bottle like this before drinking any alcohol to avoid a next morning where you can't talk straight at all. And that, frankly, I feel pretty good today. A little tired. I was up late. But you drink this much, and it doesn't matter if you have one drink or a couple of drinks or multiple drinks. You pace yourself. You drink responsibly, of course. Try and get as much sleep as you can. And the next day, you're feeling good. And how does it work? Generally, or I used to think that the reason why you felt miserable the next day after drinking was you got totally dehydrated. There's a little bit of dehydration, but apparently there's a byproduct that alcohol releases into your gut, and that's what really does it. Well, this probiotic essentially neutralizes that byproduct. It is real science that works. It is not random vitamins and plant extracts like everything else. I used it on the cruise. I used it last night. It's great. And now you can get 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic by clicking the link in the description box. Use my code majority at checkout. So you go to zbiotics.com, ZBiotics.com/majority. You get 15% off your first order. Check it out, and you will not be disappointed. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Ann Newman, journalist and Pulitzer Center grantee, on her reporting on the ground in Ethiopia. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, joining us, Ann Newman. She is a journalist and a Pulitzer Center grantee. She has written a piece in Harper's Magazine in the January issue, I think it is, of Harper's Magazine, on the war in Ethiopia and its crime against civilians. And Ann, welcome to the program. And I guess the central thesis of your piece is that there has been crimes against civilians that the war has brought about, that it is hard to really say that it's been exclusively one side or the other in this conflict.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge of the war, beyond the fact that its context is complicated and it's impossible to get to the territory where the war is actually taking place. The challenge was how then to write about the atrocities that this war brought about for Ethiopian people. And we'll get into the logistics, I assume, but that northern state of Tigray, which has been cut off from the rest of the country and was besieged by the federal troops, was impossible to get to. Any reporters there, local journalists or international journalists, were detained or booted out of the country. And this had gone on for a period of time. And I decided that it was still worthwhile to go and talk to refugees if I could find them. To talk to Tigrayans throughout the country who were also experiencing harassment, and to see what was taking place in the country itself, because even though the federal troops were portraying themselves as the good guys, even though I could only be in safer territory, there was still a lot of violence that had taken place. And I just want to say it's the February issue.
Apologies.
Not
apologies.
At all. yes, a lot of violence. And I just wanted to, because no one else was writing about it, I wanted to see what I could do.
You know, I have to say, this is the second interview I've done in this conflict. And I held off for a long time because of more or less what you're expressing. I just had no sense. And there is such a concerted effort, it seems like, by both parties to claim that the other is engaged in a successful propaganda program, that it becomes really hard to assess from this distance. And I guess it was with mixed emotions I had that you found it hard to assess on some level, even from that close proximity. From sitting here in Brooklyn, it seems virtually impossible. But will you just give us, we've gone through this a little bit, but I'd like to refresh people's memories. Give us a little bit of the context for this conflict, because for years, when you talked about conflict in Ethiopia, it was with Eritrea. And almost what feels like in just a short period of time, that sort of reversed.
Right. Yeah. And Alex DeWall, I believe, was your prior guest. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He's fantastic, really knows his stuff. But also, on social media and elsewhere has been undermined and, called horrible names and deeply criticized. It's a deeply polarizing, situation. I'll start with 2018. There were riots taking place all over Ethiopia, and the sitting then president decided to abdicate his role, and the ruling party, which is a coalition of various groups, the EPLF, EPRDF, went through the process of trying to find a new leader, and they landed on Abiy Ahmed. And of course, in Ethiopia, we use the first names. And Abiy was half Oromo, half Amhara, and young, has a PhD, very appealing. And he seemed like the right person. He came to power, and the West loved him. He had a huge movement and support base in Ethiopia. He very quickly went to Eritrea, one of the most authoritarian nations on the continent, but certainly in the world, and made peace with Isaias Afwerki, who has been the leader there since 1991. And we can go back and track some of that interesting history at some point. And for that peace, Abiy won the Nobel Peace Prize, and things were looking up and up. He had a lot of great language around him, talk of unity and democracy. And, you know, he comes from a prosperity gospel type background and really wanted Ethiopia to develop. But it seems now that peace deal also involves some conversation of how to get rid of both Abiy's enemy, as far as power goes, and Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki's old enemy, the TPLF, or the Tigray People's Liberation Front. And that TPLF leadership, after they lost power, retreated to their home state of Tigray, which is in the north of Ethiopia. It's right against the Eritrean border. And in fact, some of the bad blood between the Tigrayans and the Eritreans dates to 2007 and 2008, and a border dispute there. There are other complications, of course, but so here are here is Abiy, new president of Ethiopia, making this peace deal that also says we're going to get rid of our mutual enemy, the Tigrayans. And there were a lot of other hostilities. I think both sides are still playing or pointing fingers at each other, and we're still not clear on when the first moves of the war were, although the TPLF has said that they acted preemptively by attacking federal bases in the Tigray state. That was on November 3rd, 2020, and immediately the federal government, under Abiy's direction, closed off Tigray. They stopped everything at the borders. They ended any kind of aid going in and out of the region. They shut down the internet, banking, cellular service, and particularly medicine crossing the border. And then a full front entered Tigray, whether it was Eritrean troops from the north or from the west, that little bit of border in Sudan. Amhara special forces from the Amhara state, which is just south and slightly west of Tigray, as well as Fano, which I spent some time with in the article, which is kind of a nationalistic or ethno-nationalist group that comes from the Amhara state. And these troops poured into Tigray, and we haven't really had a clear picture of what was taking place in Tigray, and we still don't. Even today, there are places that are inaccessible. There are rural areas without water, without electricity, without cell service. So here we are after a peace agreement last November. The war lasted with ups and downs that we can get into until last November when two peace deals were signed, one in Pretoria and one in Nairobi. But still, these borders are difficult to cross, and we don't have a full picture of what took place in Tigray during the war.
The opportunity for Abiy to make peace with Eritrea by basically saying, like, we have a shared enemy, so, you know, maybe we should be, maybe we can deal with this. The Tigrayans as that shared enemy, that dynamic shifted because the Tigrayans as a, I guess a, what would we call it, an ethnicity in Ethiopia had been essentially ruling the country or rulers of the country for what was it, the 30 or 40 years?
27.
Yeah. And so, The shift happened when the Amhara came back into power and then had the ability to basically say, like, our chief rivals are the Tigrayans. That's also the case with you, Eritrea. We can come together here.
Well, Abiy is a little confusing, right? He's only part Amhara, but he has used the tool of Amhara nationalism to support his endeavor. And the TPLF have an interesting history with Eritrea themselves. If you know that backstory, when Ethiopia was governed by the communist group, the Derg, from the fall of Haile Selassie, so the 70s, until roughly 91, the Derg were overthrown by a combination of Eritrean liberation groups led by Isaias Afwerki, and liberation groups from Ethiopia, specifically Tigray, and that was Meles Zenawi. So these two were bosom buddies, and it's really only because of the coordination of both of them that they were able to overthrow the Derg in 1991. Eritrea got its independence. Ethiopia then was able to push toward modernization. They're the ones who set up kind of this ethno-nationalist federation of states. There are 11 states. And they established a constitution and did a lot to bring, services and infrastructure to Ethiopia. But they were also pretty strong-handed, and their rule was protested for many years.
I had visited Ethiopia back, I think it was in the late 90s. And I just remember having spoken to someone, I can't remember if it was maybe a taxi driver, who was talking about the Eritrean-Ethiopian war and saying it was like two bald men fighting over a comb. Like, what are the combs even here? Like, it's unclear to me, what are their resources? I mean, I understand the idea of, like, I want power, and the Tigrayans are a challenge to my power, but over what? Is this a resource fight, or is it just simply, I mean, I'm just unclear on what is driving the motivations for these, because it's, you know, at one point, these two are allied, the Eritreans and the Tigrayans are allied, and then the Amhara and the Eritreans are allied against the, I mean, it just keeps shuffling around. It's unclear to me are there any sort of like, I guess, sort of static realities about resources that are involved here?
Absolutely. I mean, there are static resources, whether it's farming, whether it's water resources, power, guns, loyalties with other nations around the world. I mean, as we know, and really my interest in Ethiopia goes back to the 1960s, when my father was there, an American soldier who was on a base, classified still today, outside of Asmara, Eritrea. And it was really American influence that kept Eritrea under the imperial power of Ethiopia until 1991. You know, Eritrea had been colonized by the Italians. They had a lot of incredible infrastructure and kind of this Western-facing identity. Not to say that racism wasn't a huge part of the colonial experience. But when the Americans and others pushed for Ethiopia to maintain control of Eritrea, it was so the Americans could keep this base. And the Eritreans were incredibly resentful. You know, Ethiopia at the time was quite feudal, and Haile Selassie was an emperor. And so the independence movement rose up there. The power struggle was for independence, to make their own decisions. You know, I could have asked you the same question maybe about Florida or Montana. Like, these are places, this is home of a population, quite ancient history, very beautiful tradition, and who makes their decisions for them, for these populations, means very much to them. Eritrea is a dictatorship, one of the most authoritarian countries, like I said, and it's a strange place to be. I went back in 2019, right after peace was made between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And Eritrea is a strange place today. One of the highest refugee populations because of mandatory conscription. In Ethiopia, Abiy wants power. I mean, Ethiopia has a fantastic economy. If you're talking about the continent, it's been one of the most stable countries in the Horn. And as you know, it's surrounded by a whole lot of trouble. Somalia is there and in the news recently. Eritrea is building a huge dam. I have a second piece about the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam and the trouble that it's created with Sudan and farther upriver Egypt. I'm sorry, downriver Egypt. The Nile, of course, flows right from the south to the north. So this is a strategic region. As I mentioned, you know, the United States had this base in Eritrea for quite a while until the downfall of Haile Selassie in 1974. But, you know, Ethiopians were great allies to the United States when they were working on, you know, that hideous war on terror, fighting al-Shabaab, other ways that the United States has partnered. You know, Nick Turse has done a lot of great reporting about how the NSA built a surveillance network in Ethiopia. So strategically and for other reasons, not just our own interests, but on the ground, there are interests that mean very much to individuals there. And one is, you know, coming democracy.
Right. So let's talk about what you found in terms of the evidence of what appears to be both sides committing atrocities against civilians.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that the concentration of atrocities and atrocities to list it is these incredible mass killings, systematic rape, use of food as a weapon of war, use of medicine, lack of medicine as a weapon of war, use of social media, internet access. But yes, the concentration was in Tigray. We still don't know because Tigray is still blacked out for us. But when the TPLF left the borders of Tigray and started to move south, they moved very quickly. They were moving toward Addis Ababa, and I had a visa. I was waiting to go to Ethiopia, and the State Department was sending me probably 3 emails a day saying, do not go to Ethiopia because we will not be able to get you out.
Wow.
I know. Whoever thought that Addis would be threatened, and yet it was. And they got as far south as maybe 200 kilometers from Addis Ababa, and then were pushed back. Their supply lines were too thin, and they just didn't have the resources. And Lalibela was one of the cities. It's a city in the Amhara state, a very holy city, churches carved out of solid rock. I don't know if you got there to see them when you were in Ethiopia. But Lalibela had been held by the TPLF for 5 months. And it seemed an interesting place to go to talk to people who could tell me what the war had been like. And so that's where I start at the beginning of the piece, where I'm in Lalibela and I happen to come across a Fano training, again, this Amhara militia that has been allying with federal troops, Amhara security forces, and Eritrean troops, and are accused of some of the most horrifying atrocities in Tigray.
What is the involvement of parties outside of Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Tigray? I mean, has there been where are all the weapons coming from? And I mean, I assume a healthy amount coming from the United States. But where is the rest of the world in terms of this conflict?
It's hard to understand. Tigray has been quite secretive and also quite cut off. The Western Tigray territory is still in contention, and that's really Tigray's only route through Sudan. So they've had, you know, Sudanese allies and others. They've also had Oromo allies. Oromo is the largest ethnic group in the country. And the federal forces, of course, you know, Abiy's been getting weapons from anyone he can, whether it's Turkey or the UAE. And Isaiah Safwerka is kind of a mystery. He's not one to give press releases on where he's getting his weapons, but he seems like he's got a good cache. He's been sitting on them for a while. So there are a number of countries in that area, particularly Middle East and other Horn nations, who have played allies, but they've played them rather loose in all of this. I think the hope is that Ethiopia remains strong, and it seems as though loyalty will go to the one who looks like he's the winner.
What would be the interests of outside groups? I guess just that Ethiopia maintains its strength and that the U.S. still has its sort of resources there, I guess, or in terms of like a base or just sort of, it's so unclear to me what the agendas are.
Well, you know, I just read a piece this morning in Financial Times about the role that Russia is playing in seeking satellites there. So they're using Wagner Group and other resources to build loyalties across the Sahel. I forget what they're calling it. It was a kind of a fancy term, but Russia is working very hard. You know, it's kind of like a post-colonial era where in my father's time, he was on in the Horn of Africa trying to secure allies for the United States. It's kind of a proxy Cold War was building from the 1960s forward. And I think we're seeing a period of time as well where China is sinking tons of money into the continent and Russia has its own power plays as well. And, you know, neither of those nations ask for humanitarian governance when they offer financing or weapons or security forces, where the United States does. And it depends on what fight you want to discuss. Is it, you know, spreading democracy, which is kind of a flaccid term at the moment? Like, of course, we don't want to see these kinds of atrocities taking place. Or is it influence? You know, when you look at the UN vote on Ukraine and Russia, should Russia be sanctioned? Look at the number of African countries that were quiet and said that it shouldn't.
Interesting.
And, yeah.
All right. Lastly, how is it that they managed to have, like, how do you shut down the entire country and have so little information come out? I mean, it's just like, it just seems, are there other outlets somewhere, you know, outside of the States? Is it, how have they been so successful in keeping, this information sort of like, so, a bottlenecked?
Yeah, misinformation, disinformation, all of that has been incredibly helpful. The borders have been impassable. Aid groups have not been allowed in. Like I said, I mean, even today, last week, a bunch of journalists in Somali state of Ethiopia were incarcerated. So I think the government is really scary. They're unscrupled and they're willing to silence anyone they can. And they, when you turn off the internet, when you turn off cell service, right, you've got refugees coming out, but they're still afraid. And also, this is a part of the world where punishment of families, of those who speak out, is not unheard of. We use a few pseudonyms in my piece. I spoke to a Tigrayan in Addis Ababa, who had been detained and incarcerated along with his wife for a period of time. You know, the federal government was doing that during a part of the war as well. Fear. And as you've seen, so much misinformation, disinformation on the internet.
Well, Anne Newman, the piece is Falling Like Leaves. It is in the February issue of Harper's Magazine. We will put a link to it. I can't recommend it enough to people. If you have been in any way bewildered by this, by what's going on there, this is a great place to start to get your bearings, both in terms of context and in terms of what's going on. Thanks so much for your time today, and great job on this reporting.
Thank you so much, Sam. Take care.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Dawn Teft. She's a lead organizer with the Emergency Workplace Organizer Committee. And Sam Harshner, who helped organize at Marquette University a union with the help of EWOC. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Dawn Teft. She is a lead volunteer organizer with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. She is also a labor organizer herself. And Sam Harshner, who is also a labor organizer and adjunct instructor of political science and history at Marquette University. Dawn, let's start with you. We've had EWOC, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, has come up a lot on the show over the past, I don't know, 6 months or so, maybe longer. I don't really have a concept of anymore. But tell us what EWOC does.
So EWOC was formed in March 2020 in response to the pandemic. It's a joint project of the Democratic Socialists of America and United Electric, one of the unions that is most dedicated to helping workers organize democratically and to helping workers take action as necessary, which is also something that DSA is very invested in. You know, democracy and action is necessary in order to get movement on the things that workers and voters both care about. And employers weren't protecting workers during the pandemic. So not enough employers were providing masks or PPE or safe distancing policies, remote work policies, or hazard pay for frontline workers. So we were supporting workers in pretty much every major industry around the country and have now helped thousands of workers as a result. And we were helping them like identify a short list of, say, key issues and create a campaign to win on those issues. And to do that, we helped them in a variety of ways, from providing them with organizing training to helping them build lists of coworkers to talk to about organizing and to planning escalating actions. And then now we've transitioned to helping workers form unions, which is our primary area of focus, since unions provide workers the ability to negotiate legally binding contracts, which means the employer can't just take back any of their organizing wins over time, which they can do if they don't have a contract, right? And so for this, we help them form organizing committees that are representative of the workplace, like in terms of, you know, gender, race, you know, background, these financial background, these kinds of things. And then educate the committee about how to have effective conversations with their coworkers that really help the group learn about the major issues in the workplace, the things that the most workers care about, the things that are rising to the surface, and that over the time, lead to commitments to form a union from a majority of workers. And right now, for instance, one of our major focuses is supporting Chipotle workers in forming unions. So if you or someone you know works at Chipotle, we'd love to hear from you.
All right. Well, I want to come back to that. But I mean, so broadly speaking, and I hate to use this word, but you guys are almost like ad hoc consultants for people who are looking to organize and perhaps unionize.
Correct. Yeah. We advise workers, but we have a very democratic worker-led process where we're really training them and then advising them along the way. And it's to empower them so that they now have this information moving forward and so that they can make informed decisions on their own. And so we're advisors, but it's always up to them what to do with that advice. And we really just try to help them sort of stay on track, move forward, you know, think strategically, things of this nature.
So, Sam, you, you're an adjunct instructor at Marquette, and Marquette instructors and academic workers, I guess, were looking to organize. So from your perspective, tell us that story, because it's almost like a case study, if you will, of what EWOC can do for folks who want to gain some power in the workplace.
Well, I should expand. I mean, there were legal impediments to us actually forming a union at the time we worked with EWOC. And so our campaign was largely focused on trying to ensure that there were no job cuts in the midst of a unique world pandemic situation. So ultimately, the work we did with EWOC allowed us to cut a proposed, 450 cuts down to about 60 people losing their jobs. So I think, they showed their worth right there. EWOC did just what Dawn said. I mean, helped us build our internal network, which meant how do you understand how to build lists? How do you have difficult conversations? How do you get over that aversion to having awkward conversations with colleagues? That's maybe the most important thing. How do you use your personal connections to try to build activists out of those friendships and acquaintanceships and your kind of relationships with colleagues? And it was, also taught us to create public-facing organizations like this Marquette Academic Workers Union, like a group called Our Marquette, which was mostly tenure-track faculty, students' organizations. that allow people to know who you are and know where to put their energy. And so all of those things were, you know, were really built off of the advice and kind of the structures Dawn provided for us.
How much experience, I mean, you're a labor organizer, and I would imagine, like, you know, folks may be in the political science department or in, you know, I don't know how it breaks down at Marquette, but there are going to be some people who are more attuned to these things and others who, less so, though they have similar complaints, but different experiences. Like what was the baseline for this? Like how much was, you know, how did that first come together? Like, you know, were people just walking around like, what do we do here? And, yeah. And then how did that sort of progress?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ambient discontent. And I think one thing Ewok does is help you bring some coherence to that. And really, we cohered around that demand, right? Nobody gets fired, right? But this built, you know, we had a unionization effort that fell short a few years prior. And so the core of the organizers came from that group. And really, we were able to reach out to Ewok, who really, you know, again, taught us how to build those networks with close associates. And you're right, some departments are more naturally inclined to do this than others, but you know, build that core and then kind of reach out. And so and that means, you know, having conversations with people in the business school, in the economics department, things like that. And what you find is that people's ideological starting point may be different, but their working conditions are similar and they're experiencing the same things in the university. And so if you can get over that hump and actually start to have those one-on-one conversations, you can build a really broad coalition.
What were the legal restrictions on your ability to unionize at that time?
There's a decision associated with Duquesne University that made it difficult for religiously affiliated private institutions from organizing their non-tenure track faculty, basically on religious freedom grounds.
Right, of course. I can only imagine that was yes. I belong to the church of don't like people to organize when I'm negotiating with them. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I don't want to get anybody in trouble here. Don, I read a piece and I guess was this in Jacobin? Maybe it was with Gabe Winant. Who we've interviewed on this program. And I think this is in his voice, but he writes, the distinctive quality of Ewok organizing became clear to me in a conversation with a worker who said to me at a crucial inflection point, I'm realizing that I can't persuade anyone of anything. I just need to tell them what I really think and ask them what they really think. And then they'll do what they're going to do. And I can't control that. Oh my God. I just realized that's what you did in this conversation with me. Will you like expand on that dynamic, like in the way, because I'm not familiar really with another model like the one that Ewok is using right now, particularly in the way that the genesis where you're not going into a situation with an agenda per se, a narrow agenda,
right.
For Ewok. Like there, you're trying to achieve almost like, you know, what they're trying to achieve. Yeah. And it's almost like a therapist on some level, or, you know, having come from the film business, you know, a good producer comes in and is trying to, like, what the director wants to do, I'm trying to sort of optimize what you're doing there. Can you talk about that dynamic and how sure. unique that is? Or are there other entities out there that are sort of doing some of that now?
Well, I mean, I'd say that part of it is intrinsic to union organizing in general, but I'd say we kind of take it to another level where it's like as member driven as or worker driven as possible. So for instance, in the organizing conversation, the dynamic you were just describing, one would never try and force somebody to, you know, take an action or form a union. What you're doing is you're trying to learn about them as people, and you're trying to learn about the issues that they care about, because people are motivated by what they care about. And so once you hear about and learn about them as people, form that relationship of trust and get at what really motivates them, then you find out, oh, you know, they really need healthcare because they've got three children, you know, and then you talk to enough people and you realize, look, a lot of people care about this. And so you can really connect people around those shared issues, and you sort of agitate them to you know, to feel the injustice of it and to feel like, oh, we're all worked up about this. We can do something about this collectively, because we're kind of taught to accept the things that we complain about, right? We're taught to accept the status quo, to complain and then move on. But part of organizing is helping people feel the injustice of it and then use that as the spur to take action. And so from there, it's like the give hope phase, the plan to win, right? We can do something about this. Other workers have won on this before. Here's how they did it. And so it's helping workers find that, right? Know how to talk to people in the ways that really foster other workers' input into the process and their abilities to assist with the organizing and be, not just be a voice in it, but be the organizing, because there is no organizing outside of a group of people. Like if you're forming a union, the union isn't a group outside of those workers. It is the workers. And so it's the most successful, the more voice that they have. And we really put that at the forefront. And, you know, Sam can attest that I helped them identify major issues, right? And then organize around those and figure out what would work best for their group, you know, given their conditions. So they're the experts in their workplace. I was never the expert in their workplace. I know a lot about academic organizing, but, you know, it was really helping them draw out the things in their workplace that would, that, that they could focus on, you know, as targets or actions to take, and then helping them refine those and things like that over time.
Sam, what was there a particular dynamic that you saw? Like, I guess what I'm thinking of is, and maybe it's different in the context of an academic setting, where, you know, there's a socialization that happens, or at least I perceive one in an academic setting that seems maybe, you know, in some ways, you know, more extensive than in other work situations. But I wonder if there were moments where there was a particular dynamic that kept coming up over and over again. Just as an example, like it just occurs to me that a realization that the individual issues that a person had with their job turns out not to just be an individual issue, but rather something structural that more than themselves are impacted by. Was that one, or were there others that you came across?
I mean, without question, you know, I think one of the key ones is universities are pretty hierarchical, right? They're almost feudal in the way that they rank people, right? And so there are, you know, there are perceived differences in conditions and real differences in conditions across that spectrum from, you know, full professor to adjunct, right? To grad worker, to staff, those sorts of things. And what you found was, in this moment of crisis, when you started talking to people, even these full professors started to see their fields and their positions as precarious in the given context, and were able to find common cause with people that they normally wouldn't even talk to. And that's true of the same sorts of divisions across departments. And I think that that was not surprising to us who were starting to organize and had felt they've been on the cutting edge of this from the beginning. But it was really, I'm really proud of the really broad coalition we put together to make this happen. And it was because of really, at the end of the day, we share these working conditions. That became very obvious.
Don, the COVID had that effect on some level of like being the great equalizer, if you will, where, you know, suddenly people realize like, oh, we're all in a similar situation. I mean, when you get to sort of like extreme contexts, these things become clear. I mean, we do this in the, in making an argument, you take it to the extremes to show, to magnify similarities or differences. How going forward, and certainly we've seen a lot of labor activity over the past, you know, 2 years or so. How going forward do you maintain the clarity that COVID, that the pandemic provided without that context, right? Because the further we get away from it, the more people are going to forget that, like, oh, wow, yeah, they're willing to put us out there. And, you know, whether it's, I don't know if I'm working as a waiter or, you know, a delivery or whatever it is, like they didn't, you know, or a factory, like they didn't really care. And like, how do you maintain that level of consciousness going forward?
Yeah. And I'd say that I think workers kind of always had that consciousness. It's just that things became, you know, even more dire in a way that they had to take action in an immediate way. And there was an organization that was there for them to do so that wasn't there previously. And a lot of workers around the country want to organize, you know, they wanted to organize before the pandemic. They still want to organize. They want to form unions. But over the decades, you know, certain politicians have made that incredibly hard. They've done all these things to create all these barriers for organizing unions, including creating a system where you have to hold an election after a card check. Card check is where you sign the cards, right? Then the NLRB schedules an election for down the line. The employer then brings in these corporate union busters to try and intimidate the employees, in essence, to scare them away from voting yes. And, you know, sometimes that's effective. And so there are all these barriers that are in the way. And one of the things that EWOC does is helps to ease those barriers, because there's only so many unions, only so many union organizers in the country, only so many resources up against, like, all of this corporate money, right? That's coming into play to prevent this from happening. And so by having this broad network of volunteers who are all over the country and willing to help people in all sorts of situations, no matter how, you know, I don't want to say how implausible, but, you know, we'll work with people in a lot of different types of situations that might not seem immediately viable. And so we can really help them create the structures to have something grow and find its legs and potential over time, and then become even more attractive to, say, a potential parent union with which they would affiliate. If they're able to, like, get the structure in place and do enough assessments of coworkers, et cetera. So we're really helping, I think, to fill a gap there. And that's necessary given all of the resources put into making organizing so difficult for workers, because workers do want it so much.
So, all right, two questions, final questions for you. If I'm working at a place and I'm like, our situation stinks here, and I don't know how to go about even approaching my fellow workers to find out, like, do they share this? I know there's that dude who works the late shift. He's been complaining about stuff, and maybe I'm going to approach him, but I want to use best practices and figure out how to do it. I'm not terribly good with people, whatever it is. How do they contact you? That's question one. And if I'm someone who's like has some experience with organizing and I want to volunteer and be part of EWOC so that I can help the guy I was just talking about in scenario one, how does that work?
So you go to the same link for both and it'll be HTTPS, /workerorganizing.org. And then /. I don't know if there's a way to even.
Workerorganizing.org should probably just take us there. And then, So what happens? Like, Sam, like, when did you do that? Like, who was the first person that reached out to EWOC? Do you know?
Friend of mine, Tom Hansberger, was the one who reached out to Dawn and Tom and I, as well as another friend of mine, Sarah Kizik, had been really core to this organizing effort early on. And he reached out to Dawn. And I mean, I just wanted to follow up on that structure argument. We still have a union fight going today. We're organizing with a national union, pushing for a union for non-tenure track faculty and grad workers at Marquette. It's a real testament to kind of the lasting power of the work that EWOC does. They give you the skills and the structures you need to succeed long term. It takes a while, but I'm optimistic because of the foundation that they laid.
How did that first instance go down? Where you go onto the website and you contact? I mean, was if you want, we can mute Don and we. No, I'm joking. But how did that go down? Because I think, like, one of the things that really prevents people from reaching out is a sense of, like, feeling intimidated. I don't know what to do here, and I'm just curious about that first initial contact, because by the time you get to where you are now, with, like, still having this union fight, a lot of those initial sort of concerns and barriers have gone away, and now you're just in the mix of the fight, and but you have the tools, and you have it really is just a question of a sheer sort of, like, a power battle. But in the beginning, it's not just a question of fighting the power of management or the employers. It's overcoming sort of some internal sort of blockages.
Right. No, and I mean, honestly, it's really easy. I mean, you reach out to Ewok, and then you get a personalized email in return, right? So somebody follows up with you, and you have a discussion. And so it's really easy. The bar is really low. I think everybody should donate to Ewok so that they have the capacity to do more work. But it's not intimidating at all. And again, I mean, I think their worker centered approach is really clear, even in that first instance where they're there to ask what's going on with you, and then, you know, kind of what you want to fight for, and they'll offer, you know, kind of some ideas for what kind of structures or what kind of assistance they can offer as a result of that. And it's a really good way to get started, because they, you know, these are some of the most experienced and effective organizers I've come across.
Well, folks can just, you can Google Ewok, EWOC, and Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee will pop up. It is workerorganizing.org. Don Teft and Samuel Harshner, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We actually did mute her by mistake. appreciate it, Don. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will recap some of the stuff that happened last night, the State of the Union. Again, like, you know, you got to preface this a lot. I found last night, you know, I found it necessary to preface. I don't think anything necessarily real or material comes out of the State of the Union. Not necessarily. Although I last night, if there's ever been an exception, it may be last night. And but as a sheer political theater exercise, to the extent that there's value there, and I do think there's value, I don't know how you would necessarily quantify it. Last night was really one of the more impressive State of the Union addresses I've seen. And I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of Joe Biden's, and did, and certainly went in with some real concerns as to whether, you know, an hour, he could pull off an hour long speech. But it was pretty impressive. And we'll go through, you know, some of the what I think are potentially the most lasting implications of a speech that generally, like a week after it's done, you never even reference it again. We'll also take your phone calls. We'll also take your IMs, which you can do through the app at majorityapp.com. If you're a member, you can IM the show. If you're a member, you also can go on the app and search. You can search the app and find all the things. And we're always adding little perks. Sometimes they're so little for members, you can barely see them. But the biggest one is you get the free show, free of commercials, and you get the fun half every day. Sometimes maybe you don't want to listen to the free show. You just want to listen to the fun half. Sometimes you just want to listen to part of the fun half. You have the option. If you're a member, all you got to do is go to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, and you will allow this show to survive and thrive. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Emma's out today, but she'll be back tomorrow. And also with ESVN on Monday.
We got OT tomorrow. We'll be doing our final picks before our competition ends, because the Super Bowl is this Sunday. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah, last three picks of the season for us before the Super Bowl.
Three picks?
Yeah, we do three picks each per week.
What do you do? Like a completion rate?
Well, this one will be tough because it's only one game. Usually we're doing lines for it, but now we'll do like over unders and stuff like that.
The betting lines, though.
Yes, the betting lines. Excuse me, but yeah. So
very
yeah,
wholesome.
We'll preview that. Preview the Super Bowl trade deadline at 3 p.m. tomorrow for the NBA. So YouTube.com/ESPN show for that.
Do you guys do like funnels on this program too?
No, shotgun a beer.
Yeah, Matt. Yeah. Triumphant return to the Matt Leck Media.
Yep, that's right. Last night it was actually David Griska Media. I wasn't there, but he did a show on nuclear energy that I think a little bit controversial to some folks. I was still on my way back from the vacation. My transportation that somebody from Eric Swalwell's office has organized me, there was some complications with it, so I had to...
Wait, what?
I'm making a balloon joke.
Oh.
but I do want to plug, I also became a monthly DSA member for exactly like reasons like the ones we discussed with the guests today. And, you know, there's a lot of like...
Oh, wait, no.
Is somebody... not super involved in the meetings, and like I think there's a lot of maybe demoralizing stuff that goes on for the folks who are really involved when it plays out on Twitter and stuff like that. But I think that stuff maybe like just needs to be channeled a little bit better. But like you see this actual work being done, and it right. makes me very proud to be a member of that group.
All right, folks, there you have it. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll open up the phones in just a moment. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
What, who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the breaks.
That's fucking nonsense.
I see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.